We're doing Ein Yaakov. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. It's a new semester, it's a new year. Ein Yaakov is a work that distills the Talmud for the stories, for the Agadah, the Agadic parts of the Talmud. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav. Rav Yehuda is the Amora, rabbi of the Talmud. His father was Rabbi Yechezkel. He was a disciple of Rav and Shmuel. Who is Rav and Shmuel? So let's organize things quickly, okay? Moshe receives Torah at Sinai. Okay, the year is 2448. We've left Egypt. We received the Torah. And when Moshe receives the Torah, he receives the written Torah. He receives the oral tradition that defines the written Torah. Moshe teaches it. Teaches us the laws of derivation. And then we have Torah, Mishnah, and Gemara. In Moshe's time, there was already Mishnah and Gemara. Only the Mishnah and Gemara didn't involve debates. It involved the reasoning of the mitzvot, the halachic boundaries, the halachic guidelines. Torah says, wear an ornament between your eyes. No one wears ornaments between their eyes. I mean, maybe the Hindus put a red little dot here, but Jews don't put an ornament between their eyes. The oral tradition says, wear tefillin, that's the ornament, above the spot between your eyes. That's not what it says in the text. That's our tradition. So every mitzvah in Torah can only really be understood based on tradition. So Moshe gives this over, and we will skip forward. First temple, second temple. 100 years before the destruction of the second temple, we have two great rabbis. Their names are Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai are the leaders of the Jewish people 100 years before the destruction of the second temple. Now the second temple period now leads us into the Tanaic era, meaning the opinions that we encounter in Mishnah are the rabbis who lived primarily from the days of Hillel and Shammai until approximately a century and a half after the destruction of the first temple.
Are they considered Tanaim?
Yes. Hillel and Shammai were the first to have three arguments. Until Hillel and Shammai, all the rabbis reached a bottom line conclusion. Hillel and Shammai had 3 points that they differed on, where they did not reach a bottom line conclusion. And that's where machloket, we start having arguments that remain. That when we learn the Mishnah, we learn there's opinion A and opinion B. Until the period of Hillel and Shammai, when there were two opinions, they reached a bottom line. In the days of Hillel and Shammai, it evolved into two schools of thought, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, two academies. And we evolve the last 100 years before the temple to the destruction of the temple, where our leader is Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, the famous Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, who met Vespasian, who lived 120 years, who was the prince when everyone else was scared to be a prince, who was not a direct descendant of Hillel. Hillel's descendants were murdered by the Romans. They tried to retain the descendants of Hillel until his young great-great-grandson, Rabban Gamliel, could take the leadership of the Jewish people. But so we have Hillel and his son Shimon and his son Gamliel and his son Shimon, who are the last four princes, the last four leaders of the Jewish people. And then the temple is destroyed and we are at the period of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai has disciples, five major disciples, right? Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah, right? The Mishnah in Pirkei Avot tells us. Rabbi Akiva, the famous Rabbi Akiva, who lived after the destruction of the temple, who was a part of the rebellion of Bar Kochva. Bar Kochva was Bar Koziva. Bar Koziva means he came from the town of Koziva. There's a town in Chronicles in Divrei Hayamim called Koziva. So Bar Kochva came from Bar Koziva. He came from the city of Koziva. And Rabbi Akiva is a disciple of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua. So if we said Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is the prince, is the Nasi at the time of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, of the temple, so then his disciples are Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua are among his five top disciples. Their disciple is Rabbi Akiva. Okay? So we evolve another 100 years. We reach the end of the Tanaic era. The end is Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, who compiles the Mishnah. Rabbi sees that in light of all the persecution, the Jews will not be able to study in academies the way they had until that generation. So Rabbi says we have to compile a Mishnah. Tosfos says Rebbe never wrote down the Mishnah, he just compiled it. Later generations wrote it. So Rebbe organizes the Mishnah into the structure we have. So that is the Mishnah. Rebbe had a student whose name was Rav. So that's the Rav we're learning about in Talmud. Rav was the overlap generation, where Rav on the one hand has halachic weight like a rabbi of the Mishnah, on the other hand he already appears in the Talmud. Rav was in Amora. And then we have another century and a half, somewhere between a century and a half and two centuries of the Amoraic period, where they developed the Talmud, Tor Ravina and Ravashi wrote down the Talmud. Yes, sir?
If he didn't actually write it down, but isn't there an opinion that Rabbi Meir compiled it and Rabbi Yehuda Anasi bases?
Thursday night. Okay, so now we begin. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda Bar Yechezkel, the disciple of Rav, quotes as Rabbi Rav. Le'olam al yimna adam et atzmo mibet ha-midrash ve'afilu sha'a achat. A person shouldn't stay out of Beis Medrash. Whenever you could come back in. Even for a short time, if you could come in, come in. Because when you miss something, sometimes you miss something that's very critical. Why? Sha'arei kama shanim nishnet mishnah zo bevet ha-midrash. The Mishnah we had learned earlier was learned so many times in the academy, ve'lo nitgala tama, and they never understood why. And then, ad sheba Rabbi Chanina ben Akavia o pirsha, that's what we saw earlier. The Rabbi Chananya ben Akavia had explained that the ship that's called Sfinata Yerdain is a ship that can become defiled, can become tamei, because it was a ship that was used both in the sea and also carried across dry land. So he said that makes it into a vessel, not just a ship. And that's why it's treated as a vessel. So he says, look at how all the years we were learning it, we never understood why. And then Rabbi Chananya ben Akavia came one day, we asked him, what's the reason for this Mishnah? And if you missed that day, you missed it. So he says, stick around, because what's the reason we don't always stick around in Beis Medrash? Because we figure, I didn't catch this week's class, I'll catch next week. I didn't catch the class now, I'll catch the next class. No, what's taught today will not necessarily be taught tomorrow. Sometimes you could learn a lot of things, and yet the important nuance which you want to catch, you might miss. If you don't catch, you got to catch it all. Yes?
How come Akavia is never called a rabbi?
Who?
Akavia.
What's that to do with this? Rabbi Chananya, we said, not Akavia. But in general, the Talmud says, Gadol Mirabban Shemo. When you don't use the title rabbi, that means he's a greater person. The logic behind it is, when we say the prophet Yeshaya, you say Yeshaya, everyone knows which Yeshaya you mean. But if you're going to say Abba, so there were 8 rabbis called Rabbi Abba. Which one are you talking about? There were a few rabbis called Hillel. Yet when we say Hillel, we mean one Hillel. So that's a greatness. It says you have Rav, then you have Rebbe, then you have Rabban, and then you have Shmo. If you could use his name alone, Gadol me Rabban Shmo, the Gemara says. If someone is so great that when you say his name, everyone knows it's him, so that's a greater level than having to use the title Rebbe. That's what I'm saying. You see that. Think about it. If I tell you Yoshua, you don't think it's Rabbi Yoshua of the Mishnah. You think it's Yoshua who was Moshe's disciple. I say Moshe, you think Moshe Rabbeinu. I don't have to say Rabbi Moshe who took us out of Egypt. You know, Moshe, there's one Moshe. So, Gadol mir Rabban Shmo. Amar Rabbi Yonatan. Rabbi Yonatan taught, Lo'olam al yimna adam et atzmo mibet ha-midrash u'midivrei Torah. A person has to know that he's always supposed to come back. This is one of the great rules. Always come back to Beis Medrash. When you choose a place to live, choose a place where you have a Beis Medrash that you could learn, where you feel comfortable, where you want to learn. Because if you always come in and learn, so then you're always connected. And if you're always connected, you're always growing. You have a moral compass, and you're growing. You're growing, your family's growing. V'afilu b'shat mita. And even when a person's on his deathbed, he should still be learning. Shenemar, as the verse says, Zot ha-Torah, Adam ki amut be'oel. the verse describes these are the laws of defilement. When a person dies in a tent, this is how you deal with a dead body. So the Talmud says there's a play on word here. This is the Torah when a man dies. Even when you're dying, Torah should still be something you're holding on to. Afilu b'shat mitah tei asek b'torah. Even when a person's on his way to the deathbed, he should still be learning Torah. And there are famous stories that way, right? Rabba was lying on his deathbed and they asked him questions. Rabbi Eliezer was lying on his deathbed, they asked him questions. There were tremendous rabbis who were on their deathbed and their last words were giving halachic ruling. They asked questions, they gave him answers. Right? The story of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. He was lying on his deathbed and he told his son Hyrcanus, he said, go light candles, it's almost Shabbos. And Hyrcanus said, oh, I have to go take my tefillin off. He said, go light candles. So the rabbis asked the kid, how's your father doing? And Hyrcanus said, I think my father's lost it. So Rabbi Eliezer yells after him and he says, I lost it, you lost it. Lighting candles on Shabbos is a biblical prohibition. Wearing tefillin on Shabbos is not a biblical prohibition. I told you to light the candles first because if the sun's going to set, you're not allowed to light the candles. What do you mean I lost it? So Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus was lying on his deathbed. And students were coming and asking him questions back and forth and back and forth. He passed away, giving halachic ruling. The last word that came out of his mouth was tahor. They asked him about a certain ball, a ball of yarn, whether that ball is considered a vessel or not by halachic standards. And he said tahor, and he passed away saying the word tahor, pure. That was Amar Rabbi Yona. So a person is supposed to learn Torah his whole life. Maybe we should take a minute to discuss that. What's the value of Torah? Why is that so important? So a friend of mine was contemplating, it's the month of Elul, he wants to prepare for Rosh Hashanah, so he wants to give charity. We're going to come in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we're going to say, Tshuvah, Tefillah, Tzedakah, Ma'avirin et Ro'ah Gzeirah. There are three components which are the powerhouse. They are the merits that help a person, even if there's been a bad decree, it annuls the bad decree. Tshuvah, repenting, Tefillah, prayer, Tzedakah, giving charity. So he said to me, I'm going to give food to the poor so that they have what to eat. I said, okay. He said, someone's telling me I should donate to a yeshiva, and I don't think I should donate to the yeshiva because I got to give the poor to eat for Yom Tov. I said, wait, you got to give the poor to eat, you also got to give a yeshiva. So he said, why? People are hungry, let them eat. I said, yeah, people are hungry, it's true, and you do have to give money for the poor, but let me ask you a question. If you feed their kids, and then their kids end up being gangsters, if you feed their kids, and then their kids end up being thieves, have you done anything? So you gave them to eat, but what did they grow up to be? The purpose of a yeshiva, the purpose of a shul, is so that people get educated, so that people are the proper citizens of society. You can't just say, I give all my money to charity to feed the poor. No. Feeding the poor is very important, but it's also very important to develop the moral compass, which will define how they grow up. You can't just say, I'm giving them money, they have food, they're okay. They're not okay. You need education. So part of our thought, the Talmud says Torah is something you got to hold on to your whole life. Torah is something that's never ending. You can always grow, you can always develop. And the more you learn Torah, the better a person becomes. So Rabbi Yonatan says, till the day you die. Now, I want to say something. We have quite a few people here who are in the gear process. There's a huge challenge when a person's in the gear process. Because when I first came to the Machon, I asked Rav Bigun if we could have tests. After I was teaching here for a year, I said if we could arrange tests, then guys could feel like they accomplished. I passed the test. I know what I know. It helps people. They have goals. And Rav Bigun said, you can't measure a person's growth with a test. Growth isn't only about information. Growth is about observing mitzvot, connecting to mitzvot. You can't measure that. It's not fair to say this one passed and that one didn't. Could be for this guy, it was a challenge to keep kosher. Now he's keeping kosher. So because he didn't get 100 on his test on the laws of Shabbat, he accomplished less in these 2 months? No, maybe he accomplished more. You can't test growth. There's no real test for that. So no, he said, there's no way we can teach with tests. Okay, fine. But we have the opposite challenge. When a person is in the gear program, so in the conversion program, you have a test. And then it's very easy to have a feeling, I passed, I'm in, I did it, finished. No, when a person converts, that doesn't mean he ended. It means he's now ready to start. You finish the conversion process, now you could start learning as a Jew. Now you have to start developing your knowledge. One of the greatest weaknesses that a ger has is that when a person finishes and gets his conversion, so then he has this huge temptation, I'm done, let me move on. You're not done, you just got started. You passed, that means you've passed the milestone, you've hit the starting line. It's not the finish line. It's a tremendous accomplishment, but now you have to start learning, and it's a lifelong process of catching up. So a person doesn't have to be hard on himself. A person shouldn't say, oh no, I'm a dunce, I don't know anything. No, a person who has done gear has accomplished a tremendous feat. But as far as a person's knowledge, they have to keep growing. And that's the idea, that a person is always supposed to learn Torah. In the Upper East Side of Manhattan, there was a shul in Washington Heights where Rabbi Soloveitchik used to pray. He used to daven. And after davening, so he would give a quick talk on halacha as the people were wrapping up their tefillin to go off to work. So everyone was wrapping their tefillin and Rabbi Soloveitchik was giving the class. Rabbi Soloveitchik was a super genius. He came to the United States, he didn't speak the language. Within a short amount of time, he was speaking on such a high level that even his students would have a hard time understanding what he was saying. They compiled a dictionary just to understand his works, because his English is on such a high level that some of the words don't appear in the dictionary. I mean, that's Rav Soloveitchik, a super genius. And when he was giving this class after prayer, so the average person was wrapping up their tefillin. There was one young man who was standing in the front, listening to every word, to catch every word the rabbi was teaching. Who do you think that was? That was the Rosh Hashiva of YU, Rabbi Hirschel Schachter. Because he knew to value, if Rav Soloveitchik is teaching a class, so then he knew the value of standing there, let me catch it, let me get every word. Back to our Ein Yaakov. Amar Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish taught. Who was Reish Lakish? So Reish Lakish was a rabbi of huge stature, he knew a tremendous amount of Torah, but he had an interesting history. Reish Lakish had learned in yeshiva and decided it wasn't for him. So he packed out of yeshiva and became a gangster. He had two partners, and they would be terrorists. They would be armed robbers. They would pounce people. They would rape. They would steal. They were really a bunch of gangsters. And Reish Lakish was huge. He had a huge build. And one day Reish Lakish was spotting out people, and he saw a beautiful lock of hair swimming across the Jordan. So he ran. He thought it was a woman. He jumped and leaped and crossed the whole Jordan in one leap. And then he looks and it's a man. And he says, what a pity. Such beauty wasted on a man. It wasn't just the man. It was his former Rebbe, Rabbi Yochanan. So Rabbi Yochanan says to him, I have a sister who's more beautiful than me. If you come back to yeshiva, I'll convince her to marry you. And again, Rabbi Yochanan is swimming. Reish Lakish leaps across the Jordan thinking he's going to rob him. And then he says, what a waste, such beauty on a man. So he just made a put down to Rav Yochanan. Was Rav Yochanan answer? And such strength should really be in Torah. You were able to just leap and cross over the Jordan. That strength should be in Torah. And here Rav Yochanan taught us a key point in education. You want to educate, you have to be able to take the put down and turn it around and tell the guy you have strength. If you take it personally, then you can't teach. If you could take the person and say, I see your strength, and if you just channel it correctly, you can grow, then you could teach. So Rabbi Yochanan says to Reish Lakish, with such strength, you should be learning Torah. And Reish Lakish, and if you'd come back, I have a sister who's more beautiful than me. I'll convince her to marry you. Reish Lakish agrees. And Reish Lakish comes back to be the powerhouse of Torah. Reish Lakish was on fire. He came back to yeshiva and he learned and he became one of the greatest rabbis in Talmud. He did tshuva. He would pray. He would do acts of kindness. He did a tremendous tshuva. And his friends died the same day he did. They came to heaven and they saw him charging forward and they were sent down. They said, wait a second, he was with us. Why is he getting a different lot than us? The Ribbono Shel Olam answered. He said, he did tshuva. What do you want? He accomplished in this world. So Reish Lakish was huge. When his Rebbe was robbed once, a group of thieves jumped his Rebbe, Rabbi Yochanan. And so Reish Lakish asked his Rebbe, which way did they go? And then he personally ran after them, and he caught up to them. So it's not the type of thing you usually do, run after a group of thieves. He was outnumbered. He caught up to them and he says, "Stop!" They turn around, they're not used to that. What do you want? So he said, "Give the money back." They look at him like he's crazy. "What are you talking about?" And he's charging on his horse. He's the one man against the whole group. And he looks at them and he says, "You know who you just robbed? You robbed Rabbi Yochanan. You can't rob Rabbi Yochanan, the chief rabbi of Israel. You just robbed. Shame on you. Give the money back." So they look at him, and after a minute, they realize he's sincere. And that's the strength of a person who's a chozer b'tshuva. When a person is a chozer b'tshuva, a person has to reanalyze their whole life and come to a level of truth that a FFB, a person who's frum from birth, doesn't often attain. The fact that a person has to make this decision and has to think it through and decide if I'm right can bring a person to a level of purity and dedication that no one else can get to. It says it about Geirim and Chozrim B'Tshuva. Two types of people who we have here, obviously, who have had to make a heart-wrenching decision. And so, because Reish Lakish is so true to the cause, they stop, and they're actually embarrassed. So they look at him, "Are you serious?" And he says, "What do you mean, am I serious? Give me the money back. Shame on you. I want that money back." So they look at him and they get a little embarrassed. They say, "Okay." They take out his wallet and they say, "Here, we'll give you half the money back. Go back, make your rabbi happy." So he looks at them and he says, "No, I said I want the full money back. You guys are not going to rob the rabbi. Come with me back to the rabbi and apologize. Come with me." And he drags them back and they give back the money and they come back to apologize to the rabbi. But that's because they saw truth in him. Reish Lakish was once captured by a bunch of cannibals, the Talmud says. And they used to give you one last wish. And by using his last wish wisely, he said, "My last wish is that I want to have dinner separately with each one of you. Each one of you should go with me into a different cave and I'll have dinner with each one of you separately." And every night he'd kill another cannibal until he killed all the cannibals and he made it out alive. You know, that was the story of Reish Lakish captured by cannibals. But back to our Gemara. Amar Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish taught... By the way, why did they give you one last wish? The cannibals believed, the Talmud says, that if you were made happy before they ate you, then you tasted better. You don't want to eat a guy who's all upset, so they said, "Give him one last wish, and then he'll taste better." They weren't doing it to be kind to the person. But back to what?
Gemara says that.
I think Rashi says it. I don't remember if it's in the Gemara or in Rashi.
Give a recipe too, some salt and pepper.
Ah, Amar Reish Lakish. Now that we understand who Reish Lakish was, a man who had left yeshiva, had led a hedonistic life. Now Reish Lakish tells us, you want to know how Torah can last within you? You have to dedicate your life to Torah. Obviously, the average Jew who's learning Torah can also grow. But he says, you want to be a person that Torah is really a part of you, you have to dedicate yourself to it. Growth in Torah involves dedication. Again, the same pasuk. Okay, and with that, we concluded that section. We have a quote, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Okay, so this is the same Rabbi Yochanan who was Reish Lakish's brother-in-law, right? Rabbi Yochanan, we just learned Reish Lakish. Now we have a quote from Rabbi Yochanan, who was so beautiful, who convinced Reish Lakish to come back. Rabbi Yochanan, who compiled the Jerusalem Talmud, says Rabbi Yochanan, "Mai dichtiv lo tasi gvur re'acha." What does it mean? Don't put your border over your friend's border. So the literal meaning of the verse is you have a neighbor, you put up a border. You know where your property ends and his property begins. So what would people do? They'd get up in the middle of the night and they'd shift the border. And that way they'd steal land from their neighbors. So that's the literal meaning of the verse. But the Rabbi Yochanan is explaining it a little differently. The verse says, "Lo tasig gvul re'acha asher gavelu rishonim." Don't shift the border that the earlier generations established. What does that mean? Gvul shegavlu rishonim lo tasig. If there are things that the earlier generations said that they know how things should be, listen to them. it goes like this. Let's say you and I are neighbors. So at the end of Sukkot, I say, I'm going to do something very simple. I want to plant in my territory an Arava branch. Okay, we're all going to shake lulav, four species. So we have an esrog, right? The esrog grows on a citron tree, esrog. We have a lulav, grows on a palm tree. Then we have an Arava. Arava grows by the rivers. They say it's a willow. I'm not sure that's an accurate scientific definition. But an Arava is a specific type of branch. It has leaves that look like the lips. Yeah, you guys know what an Arava looks like. Similar to a willow. So Arava is a very easy branch to grow. After you shake your lulav, so after Sukkot, you take off all the leaves, you put it in a cup of water, change the water every 2-3 days, and after about a month or two, even a month, you'll see it develops roots, you stick it in the ground, it grows. You want to do it the easy route, just stick it in the ground and water it often, and most of the time it'll grow. I did this. My parents had a yard, and I would stick in after Sukkot, we were a bunch of brothers, I'd stick in the ground 10 aravos, and out of 10, 4 or 5 would last, and we'd have arava trees growing in the backyard. Okay, what's the challenge with an arava tree? That the arava roots smell water, and they penetrate. And they could penetrate all your piping in the house. They can destroy the piping of a house. So I'm a wise aleck, and I'm going to plant an arava tree at the edge of my yard, not far from your house. And you'll come and tell me, that's not fair. And I'll say, I'm planting it in my yard. What do you want? So Rav Yochanan says, when the verse says, don't trespass the border that earlier generations established, he's talking about earlier generations of non-Jews. That the Emori, there were social norms in Israel, where they said, if you want to plant this tree or this plant in your yard, you have to give a certain gap between your property and the neighbor's property before you plant it. Give room for the roots to spread, for the branches to spread, so you don't harm your neighbor. So when the verse words it, the verse says, don't trespass the border that earlier generations established. Explains Rav Yochanan, that's talking about the social norms that existed in the land before we moved in. The non-Jews figured out how far you have to distance your plants so as not to harm your neighbor. Don't trespass that. You could say, what did they know? They were warlocks and witchmongers. What did they know? No, they knew what they were talking about in this. That's why the verse says that. May gavlu, amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, amar Rabbi Yochanan. May dichtiv ele bnei Seir hachori yoshvei haaretz. The verse describes the descendants of Seir. So when the verse wants to describe to us Esav's family, the verse says, this is Esav's descendant, this is the people who lived on Mount Seir. Why is that important? So Rambam has an interesting line here. Rambam says, we have a mitzvah to fight Amalek, right? There's a nation that is our arch enemy. They always fight us, and if we turn our back on them, they're going to come back to haunt us. So the Torah says you have to fight them. That's why the Torah gives you the exact genealogy of who Amalek is. It tells you, don't get mixed up. This is Seir, this is Esav. The Torah gives you the genealogy so you won't fight people who are innocent. So that's what we have, a whole section in Torah that describes genealogy of non-Jews. Why is that important? That's Eileb Nei Seir, that's the Rambam's explanation. So the Pasuk describes them as the people who lived in the land. So the Gemara asks, Atu kuli alma yishvei rakianinu? Everyone else lives in the sky. These are the only people that live on the land. Why does the verse say these are the people who lived in the land? They knew how to live in the land of Israel. They were masters of the land of Israel. So what does this mean? We are taught that there are veins that run across the land. Meaning, just as a human being has a heart, and then arteries that come out of the heart, right? And so the whole body lives. So we are taught that both in the physical and in the spiritual sense, the land of Israel is the heart of the world. And the Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, is the heart of the world. And the Medrash says that there are veins that run out of Israel to every country. And it happens to be that, factually, this has been supported. How so? So the Medrash says that every country you find can grow specific crops. you should know that if you could only find the vein that runs from Israel to that country, if you plant along that vein, which is pretty wide, then you can grow the same crop that that country can grow. So some agriculturalists decided to try and test this. And they started researching. And they brought in bananas from Jamaica, and they brought in lychees from China, and they brought in many different types of exotic fruits, and they started researching, can we really grow all these fruits in Israel? And so far, they haven't found a food they can't grow in Israel. Even foods that countries stated that couldn't be grown anywhere else, they were able to grow in Israel. There are foods that are considered, you can only grow this type of exotic fruit in this country, and they discovered there are places in Israel where you could grow that. Israel is unique. You have so many different climates in one little country, right? Where else do you find that you can go skiing in the morning, and then you hop on a short hour plane ride across the country, and you could go sunbathing in the desert, right? You have everything in one little country. You have all the different climates. So we are taught that it's not only climates that you have here. You also have nutrients in the ground that don't exist in every other country. Every country has the things they can grow. In Israel, if you can access the nutrients correctly, you can grow everything. And it says that in ancient times, people knew how to taste the soil. They could taste the soil and tell you this area you could grow this type of crop. That area you could grow that type of crop. So the Gemara says that's why they are described as the people who lived in the land. What the Pasuk is telling us, they could look at an area and tell you, this part of your field, you should grow an olive tree. This part of the field, you can grow grape trees. And on that part of the field, you're going to be able to grow a fig tree. They were able to smell the soil and tell you what could be grown there. Chivi, why are they called chivi, like the snake? Amarav Papa, it's time for Mairav?
Yeah.
Shker, so we'll pick up here next week.